Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. So thank you for being here, and let's get on into it. I have my great friend with me today, Mr. Bradley. We used to work together. He's a fantastic leader. He's a man. He is an artist. He works with food. That's why we were in the kitchen together. But I have him here today just so we can talk about life and kind of just bullshit about stuff. Tell me about yourself, bud.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. I just got nervous. Okay, so I am a chef. I've been doing that my whole life. I really enjoy spending time with my wife. I really enjoy being outdoors. Working on selling my home. Got two dogs. Love spending time with my parents. That's the nutshell.
What was your childhood like? Did you grow up here?
No. So I moved out here 10 years ago. We moved out from California because California got a little too expensive. Moving out here immediately felt like I completely took the pressure off financially. Like all of a sudden I'm like, oh, I can just like fill my tank. That's cool. Oh, I can just like go buy stuff. Like I don't have to like really think about it. I didn't have to really think about it. And then once I started budgeting, I started just actually getting ahead in life, which was like a bizarre feeling to me because like I grew up not, I don't want to say poor because it's, you know, we had food, you know, like we had food, we had each other, we had
You're American stuff. Poor.
I was American poor, right? You know, like I grew up around rich kids. So it made me feel particularly poor. Whereas like I wasn't particularly poor, you know, like both my parents were divorced and stuff growing up, but they, you know, both were able to like rent an apartment most of the time. You know, there's times where it got a little rougher than others. The worst it got is I slept on a recliner for a few years. But like, you know, I'm genuinely grateful that we didn't have what a lot of people I grew up with had, because what we had was like each other. And we had family, we had love, we had like a living room, like a real, you go home and you spend time with your family watching TV in the living room. It's like a weird thing that people just don't even understand all of a sudden nowadays. But like my family was tight and we still are. I just got back from like literally came from my family's house. I see them every weekend. I love my parents.
So you moved out here with them?
No. So I moved out here with my girlfriend at the time, now wife. But my parents followed me out here after I just like bragged to them for a few years, and I like came back and visited them, and I'm like, check out all these pictures of Colorado, and like look at this, and like it's so easy to like save money out here because like my habits from saving money in California just to get by make it easy. And then they all moved out here, like my mom, my dad, my mom and sister, and then my dad came out, basically just like all followed me out here and were immediately happy. Like nobody had any issue with that move at all. Not to shit on California.
That's crazy. That says something about California.
Yeah.
Because you have all these people who are running away from Colorado because of increased prices for housing. But you're damn right. Because like my dad, he has to basically rent an apartment in California. Yeah. I don't know if they're doing it anymore because I guess like film in general is leaving California.
Really?
Like film in general in the U.S., has took like a fucking nosedive like in the last year. And so a lot of the film is moving to places like the UK and like, you know, just other places that are allowing tax breaks for it. And so like a lot of my dad's work has left.
You know? Do you think that that's because of like the rise in streaming? Like because there's so much like privatized, like different ways to get your media that people aren't going to the movie theater as much anymore?
100%, but even like consider like Netflix shows.
Right.
Like Netflix is a lot of the material. And right. These people who are making the Netflix shows have to rent places to work at. And a lot of these places will have tax breaks. And so Colorado gives tax breaks. And then California gives tax breaks. And then Georgia gives tax breaks. And so that's a major draw for businesses is how much money they can save. I think the biggest factor is that across the board, our country has just thrown out every incentive for good business, period. Like
it's more about profit now.
Not even that. Like it's all about selfishness, whereas good business is about interacting and forming co-independent situations with people, you know? Mm-hmm. Like whereas if you don't provide the incentive, if you don't give like a tax breakout, you know, like I guess it's a bad analogy to like look at welfare, but like all in all, our whole disposition right now is taking away money given out to people for food. You know, we only give handouts to people.
Right.
You know, so we say we're broke, we have all this debt, so we need to stop giving people money. Whereas in a community-based system, you give people money that improves the whole community.
Well, because if people don't have money in a community, they can't contribute to the community at all.
Exactly.
And they can't at all further their community. And when they're particularly broke in today's society, they start outsourcing. I'm going to just find the more convenient, less community way to go about this. Like, I could go to the bakery, the local baker, and get bread.
It'll be more expensive.
But it's more expensive than Walmart.
Exactly.
But what's better for your community? You know, like that's the, you know, that, and you know, we go way far back in time, and people have been, governments have been issuing stimuluses for a long time to stimulate that type of growth. It's an understood thing, you know, to inflate your microeconomies with, you know, just liquid cash. Mm-hmm. Hey, we give people money, they spend it on local businesses. Great. The problem with that in the past is that when a society is in a position to try and do that, like, hey, we need to try to bolster our economy by stimulating it by just giving people cash, if the people are desperate enough, they're just going to take that cash and save it. Mm-hmm. And now, great, now they have some cash saved, but they're not stimulating the economy in the way that was intended.
It has to recirculate.
Yeah, it has to recirculate.
You got to go buy shit.
You got to go buy shit with that money. Exactly. And if you just save it, like, good for you, but that's like a very selfish approach to like the overall idea of what a stimulus is about.
So what do you think about proposed UBI, like universal basic income?
So that's like a tough one, man, because the tough one for me on that is I've just yet to hear like a rational approach to it.
What do you think people would do? Do you think so?
I think it would be really rough at first. I don't think it would work at first, but I think that if we gave it the time that it would need to actually become somewhat of a norm, that people receive somewhat of a universal income, at least to subsidize us for certain things, mm-hmm. would be at the very least appropriate. I think food stamps should be something that everybody gets.
Oh, 1,000%. Or you know, healthcare.
Or healthcare should be a right. You know, like, yeah. That should be a God-given right. Like, you have no ability to take away my health. You know, at the very most, they should be like, oh yeah, no, you've got something real bad. Like, you know, this is going to take all this surgery. We're going to need $20. You know, like, that's at the worst, right? Your but no, payment. We're going to put you into a position where, because of no fault of your own, I had a friend that I worked with, a chef who had a heart condition when he was younger, when he was born. He was born with a heart condition. Many surgeries growing up. At the very worst of it, he was 23 when his debt was at its highest, and it was like $1.7 million. Just all paying medical. That off for the rest of his life. Yeah. All medical. He was born this way, you know? He's lucky to be alive. You know, if he was born like 20 years earlier, 15 years earlier, they wouldn't have been able to do anything about his condition. I don't remember exactly all the details, but he sure. explained it all to me, and it's upsetting to me that's just the cards you're dealt. Is like, oh, you know, you got in a car accident, sorry, but now you're in debt for the rest of your life because you broke your back.
Or you choose to go to school.
Yeah.
Or gifts. So, on this idea of like UBI, though.
Right, right.
Hypothetically, it is enacted. I guess my chief concern is that all throughout human history, we've morphed, we've evolved, we have this new type of human that we are now, and now it's so dramatically fast. You know, like, my child is going into a world that I do not understand, that he is preparing himself for somehow, but all throughout human history, no matter what it is, humans have had to have some sort of work, you know, like in a very ambiguous, not for money, like this isn't work,
a purpose,
not work for money, but you know, like even hunter-gatherer societies, you have to get up and you have to find firewood, you have to go hunt, you have to go get water, boil water, right. Or you have to move because the area you're in is now stripped bare. Yeah. You know, they had to work even though there was no money for it. I just finished this book by this dude named Eric Fromm, and it was called Escape from Freedom. And his thinking's really impressed upon me a lot. And what he basically said is that we've moved away from that archaic ancestral way of being, and now we have ascertained more freedom from having to go hunt and gather, you know, because right. these individuals didn't have the choice to do their work.
This is survival.
Exactly.
Right.
So now we have this existential freedom, but we're divorced from reality in the same way that that hunter-gatherer was connected to his work, you know? Right. And so, like, basically he thinks a lot of our anxieties that we have in our new era is because we have too much freedom, you know? We have this like think Netflix when you're, I keep pulling up that fucking analogy.
Yeah, right.
But you have like a bunch of shit in front of you, or you're in a supermarket, and like I like you trying to find a box of cereal or a box of mac and cheese, and if there's too many options, then I just kind of just puzzle out and I go.
Yeah.
Like, so in UBI, that would be the crucial crux point, because that facet of our being isn't going to go anywhere. You know, there's right. still going to be a need for work. And like, in a way, I think we've overdone the extreme so much nowadays, because we have this anxiety from freedom, according to Fromm. And he says that one of the ways that we try to get away from that anxiety is by throwing ourselves into activity. And this is what I do, you know, like, and on my days off, it's hard, because if I'm working, quote unquote, it's easy because I can just throw myself into that action.
Right.
But now I'm at home alone and I got nothing to do for the day. I'm supposed to be relaxing. And like that motivator, that taskmaster, that need to work is still going. So that's my biggest concern about these humans going into a situation where they're given their money. What do they do?
So I think there's a big argument to be made that you could replace that sort of need to do something with any form of expression. As long as you're doing something that keeps you active and engaged enough and serves some sort of a purpose. It could be doing art. It mm-hmm. could be simply landscaping your house, making your house look freaking gorgeous.
Or influencing.
You know, doing something, having some kind of a project. It could be a hobby. It could be something that you're actually able to sell and make money on. I don't think that a universal income would eliminate all work. Mm-hmm. I think it would eliminate the need for work.
Necessity.
You know, the necessity, right?
Because, like, we need to work or else the apartment is gone.
But, right, there'd still definitely be people working. There's, you know, it would just be like, I do this because it's more fulfilling for those people that are working those still, too, because they know that they're choosing to do that. Right. And the incentive for that is where things get a little hairy. Like how much do you make if you are working in a society where you just get universal based income? And that would be like the entry phase of that, you know, the first couple of decades of people getting universal based income is that would be the part that's like really hard to figure out for everybody is like, why do I work? Why do I not work? Why do they work? You know, like who's working, who's not working until it reaches a certain point of stability. I think that, everyone would get used to it and find purpose without it having to be working for somebody else.
What would these people's mental health look like during that transition?
I don't think it would be great for everybody.
How would you feel?
Me personally, I feel like I would have a tough time letting go of work. I've been a work hard every day all your life. Like I said, I didn't grow up poor, but I grew up, you know, America poor. So I knew I had to work. I didn't have college paid for me. I knew I wouldn't. I knew I had to do it for myself. So I just put my head down and worked. I worked the long shifts. Anytime I could work more, I did. And eventually, it like paid off in that I got like a well-paying salaries chef position. But like, you know, there's an argument to be made that I worked away the best years of my life at the same time. I'm 30 now. I spent the majority of my life working, and I've spent most of my time saving money rather than going and doing things.
Isn't that kind of ludicrous?
Right. And like, that's the thing. It's like you work just to save money so that you can work more to save money so that you can buy a house at some point. And then like eventually. And like, yeah, exactly. All that it ended up doing for me. And this is like a big, big thing that I'm coming to terms with still. Currently, I've been having a lot of these more existential thoughts about this specific subject in the last few days and weeks. Is that like, what's the point of me doing all this work? What's the point of me making more money? Like, what am I doing all these things for if I'm not like living my life, you know, and like going and doing things? This summer, I did more things than I've done in the last half of a decade. I went to like over a dozen concerts and raves. Like, I went out paddleboarding every other weekend. I went, you know, I'm playing disc golf 2-3 times a week. You know, and I'm still busy with my job, But I've made a very conscious effort to prioritize other things in my life.
Dude, that's awesome.
No, yeah. It's been huge for my mental health. And, you know, in that whole process, I there's a lot of things that happened in my life that, like, made me kind of have to come to terms with that. Like, me and the wife went through some struggle. You know, she's been gone for the last year, and she's moving back in actually next weekend, which is exciting. But, like, you know, all of that forced me to gain perspective on what's really important, you know. And I always knew that what's really important is the time you spend with people. So it's not like we didn't spend time together. We just didn't make the memories to really drive the why, you know, like, why are we together? Just to be together? No, we're together because when we're together and we do things, we have fun and we make memories, you know. But if we're just sitting at home trying to save money, we're not making memories. And, like, it just felt like at a certain point in our relationship that we were not, like, going the right direction. And then I think we both kind of realized after being apart for so long that it was just that we didn't treat each other with that sense of, like, let's go live life. It was like we were waiting to live our life somehow. And, yeah.
That's awesome.
It's liberating to kind of get there.
I'm really happy for you.
Yeah, me too.
I just signed up for a dating profile for the first time.
Yeah.
I'm using the Facebook shit, which it's kind of sad because, like, I follow a lot of, like, science podcasts and, like, all these intellectual kind of podcast shit. It's like, right. That's my bread and butter, and I love it. Yeah. And so one of the statistics that has been shared on a couple different things is that, like, the period of internet dating is kind of, like, falling apart at this point. Like, the golden era was, like, almost 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And, like, when everybody was signing up for it, I didn't do it. And so, like, I've never, ever done any of this internet shit. Mm-hmm. And I'm also, like, busy and work-bound, and I'm a dad. And so it's, like, I don't know how to go out and meet women. And so it's, like, I'm like, well, fuck it, I'll finally do this. And I start hearing all the statistics about how nobody's using it. And so I'm like, well, that's fucking great. But, like, one of the things I put is, like, that's what I want. I would like to have somebody to experience things with. You know? And, like, if I didn't have my son with me, I don't know where I would be. Because, like, life in our society, in the Western world, is incredibly isolating. You know, that's one of the reasons, at least from Fromm's perspective, the guy in the book I was just telling you about, is that hunter-gatherers were very not isolated. they were the opposite of that.
No.
And now we have so much freedom that we can buy our houses and we can isolate ourselves and live alone and all that kind of shit. But nowadays you have to go out and find people almost. It's a little more difficult. And, like,
it's different because the amount of people that do isolate like that limits the numbers. The amount of activities that are more and more relevant to people nowadays and moving forward in the future become more and more relevant are activities that don't necessarily involve going into a social atmosphere.
There needs to be more of that, though.
There does. I've seen some bit of resurgence where people are using these online medias to just meet up, basically. There's literally, like,
there's an app meetup.
Yeah. Like, you know, like I had a friend that was, like, telling me, like, oh, you're struggling to start mountain biking? I bought a mountain bike. And I'm like, I want to start mountain biking. But it was, like, tough to get into it. And I felt like I, like, needed more guidance on it. I didn't have anybody to show me, right? I just, like, decided I wanted a mountain bike and decided I wanted to do that. And, you know, like, they're like, well, go on Meetup. Like, you can meet people there. And, like, you know, you can find groups of people. It's not just, like, this app, like, not sponsored by Meetup. You know,
yeah,
like,
no, I know exactly what you mean, though. You know, can use these social interfaces with the internet to meet people.
That's how they're designed. It's just, like, the design got skewed when it became more about interacting with the app
and ads,
right.
And, yeah.
The idea of these apps and the conception, sorry, that's my phone. The idea of these apps conceptually was to bring people together using an online medium to do so. And, like, now they've just formed into doom scrolling and, you know, keeping your attention as much as possible and targeting you with the most appropriate ads as they can.
What do you think about people communicating with each other through AI? Like, so I've heard about some people get, like, a work email and they'll feed that work email to the AI and have the AI then respond to it for them to another person.
Why?
Now that other person may have an AI. And all of a sudden now their AIs are talking and nobody's actually communicating.
That's bizarre.
It is bizarre.
That's just like lazy and people not doing their jobs, it sounds like. But
that's the extreme.
Yeah, no, that's the extreme. It's like, oh no, there's so much crazy stuff about AI. That's such a rabbit hole to dive down.
So let's bring it back to UBI.
Oh yeah, yeah.
One of the things that I heard recently, because I've been trying to expand my purview on what I listen to. So like, for instance, I've never been the biggest fan of Joe Rogan since the beginning.
Right.
You know, when everybody was on, like, he's not as popular as he used to be because of all this Trump bullshit and like a lot of the pandering that he's done. But like, even like 5-6 years ago, and he's still number one. He's still the biggest podcast in the world.
Right. But pretty much right when it went to Spotify, everything kind of was going downhill.
Yeah, I would say he still is number one. That's crazy.
Well,
but like, it's changed a lot. But even then, I would shit talk the man all the time. And I was never listening to him. And so, you know, like I'm starting to listen to some of his shows just to get more of a seeing what's going on in the world, you know? Like, because I spent all my time with all these dead dudes and all my books from people from hundreds of years ago. And like, I barely even tipped my toe into modern philosophy. You know, I'm just barely starting to get to that point. Like, usually people have been dead for hundreds of years, you know? And so I've been trying to just look at the world more. And a lot of the media that I was getting that was being fed to me was mainly left sort of stuff.
Right.
And I'm not left or right, and I'm not really grossly political or not. But I wanted to pointedly listen to these people that I knew that I was going to disagree with. You know, and so I've been listening to Tucker Carlson, listening to fucking Joe Rogan.
Yeah.
And I listened to his interview last week with Elon Musk. It was another dude that I fucking hated the whole fucking time. But Elon Musk wants what he calls universal high basic income. He thinks it's possible with the use of AI to give everybody everything, where every individual would basically be rich at this point. You know, like that's the kind of future he wants to fucking see. And like Joe Rogan's like, that's the best fucking possible future ever. You know, and like in my mind, I don't even know if it like, cause, like just like we're talking about, I have no idea what I would do with myself without work at this point, because my one day off, I get so anxious, you know, like it's
yeah.
Like for me, work is essential, which is, it's maladaptive in a certain way, you know?
But that's like conditioning, right? Like that's just how you've been conditioned your whole life. That's what you need to do is work.
I'm not even sure of that. Like, because even when I'm not getting paid, like on my day off, I'm frantically cleaning my house and like finding things to do because there's like this need, you know?
Right.
Like, and so if I was given the world and I was rich, you know, I would probably need to go build a log cabin. I would need to have a long list of things that I would need to teach myself. You know,
But that's the beauty of it, is you could just do whatever you want with it.
100%.
Like I think that if you did just have, like if that perfect world existed and everybody just got like universal high income,
yeah.
Like I think that people would at first be very much
jolted,
apprehensive and jolted and not know what to do with themselves. And very much, there'd be an adjustment period for sure. But I think after like everybody adjusted to this new concept of I could just do whatever I want, we'd see so much creativity and so much like new ideas and the problem with AI, not to get into AI, but like the problem we're going with AI is that AI is, we're teaching it to do all the wrong things. We're having it do all of our art and like, you know, write all of our songs and make all of our music. I want it to do the opposite of that. I
want to
make
fucked.
The music. I want to draw the art. I'm terrible at both of those things. AI to do the stupid work for me. The work I don't want to do, the arduous stuff. Like,
have you seen the new season of Rick and Morty?
Yeah, I have.
I'm fairly sure all that music's AI music.
Yeah.
And it threw me off for the first time. I'm like, there's no way that, and I'm like, oh, that makes sense.
You know, and like the problem with like AI doing expression, any form of expression thing, like art or music or anything like that, that humans created, is that it's just copying us.
It's all imitation.
It's copying us, it's imitating, it's reiterating, rinsing and repeating. And then when it starts to pull sources from other AIs that are doing that, it's a circular spiral, and it's all going down. It's all spiraling into this mess.
So I love what you're saying, and I agree completely. But could art itself be an imitative process, like from the very beginning? Like, because the act of trying to draw a picture is imitating reality.
Right.
Right? So like on its nose, from the very beginning, art is an imitative act.
Right, but with the expression of our way of thinking,
our feelings,
our feelings, our interpretations of 100%. Things. We talked just before we started actually recording here, we were talking about how AI is in a box. You know, it doesn't have senses of the world. We do, and because of that, we all have a different interpretation. You and I will both sit on a ridge staring at the same sunset, and it'll be different for both of us.
Mm-hmm.
We might be able to describe the same exact scene to each other, but the way our eyes see it and our brains interpret that signal is going to be different.
In the past.
There's no doubt.
And like our memories sort of like paint the experience as well.
Well, and then our memories get altered and changed throughout time. And then that creates a new different expression of something that happened. And everybody's interpretation of one event happening is going to be different depending on everybody's past mm-hmm. and everybody's, you know, like presence and state of mind when that thing happened, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
So.
No, I completely get it. So like, when we get, because it's coming, like I feel like I'm just on the very tail end, because I've only started to immerse myself recently. You know, like I started playing with these chatbots about like probably 2 or 3 weeks ago, and I on my phone I've downloaded all the big ones, you know, like because they're all different models, mm-hmm. you know, and like when I heard Musk talk about his Grok shit, and he's like, ours is the fairest one on the market. You know, we've trained it to be the most fair. So get this. One of the things I like to do is I'll give the same prompt to all of them to see like if I get different answers. Mm-hmm. And one of the prompts that I gave all of them was, what is your opinion of race relations in the United States? Mm-hmm. Grok, which is Elon Musk's, was the only one that said any particular color or noted an ethnicity. And they all kind of talk about the same shit, you know, but Grok was the only one that was like, black people have made gains, you know, like, and the whole disposition was leaning towards kind of like soft padding the issue with African-Americans in the United States.
Well,
like, and it's like
interesting thing about that is, yeah, I don't know if you know this, but Elon Musk, like, very freely admits that he is specifically trying to train Grok and get that AI to not be politically correct and not hang itself up on the idea of equality and things like that, and just to be a more, that's what he said when he says fair, that's what he means, is less inclined to take any sort of a bias on anything, in the sense of like taking consideration, like considering somebody's race and stuff. It's meant to be more blunt and more like overtly, like straight to the point, and less worried about hurting feelings and stuff. But it ended up just being racist.
Yeah.
And they ended up having to like literally like shut it down and restart a couple of times because it just got like racist as fuck. Like they couldn't control it. And they're like, that's not what we're really going for. And I don't think Elon is trying to make it a racist thing. I just think that all of the things in his head that he sees as like being annoyingly politically correct are not necessarily annoyingly politically correct to everybody. You know, like to me, they're just things that's like, well, you're trying too hard to achieve something that's like already kind of being achieved by AI. It's pretty like objective already. Mm-hmm. Like it's not really considering people's races. You're the one introducing that as like a concept to it.
Yeah.
And like, so now it's just confused and it doesn't know. It needs to get the answer right. So it's just trying. And when you're giving it prompts to not take something into account that it's already not taking into account, now it takes that into account.
So how much have you played with these things?
Not a ton. I've I've played with them a little bit. It was several months ago when I actually was like playing around. I did the same thing you did, actually. I was pulling up different ones, giving it similar prompts, mostly like looking to see if like one would overtly lie to me and then like try to keep the lie.
Well, you have to be careful about what you ask, I think, is what I've kind of noticed with the damn thing. Like, so one of the, like, my favorite so far, I think, is the Claude one. I like Claude from Anthropic. And I asked it this question. I was like, do you think that an artificial intelligence can have an altered state of consciousness?
Yeah, right.
You know, and I was like, you think a robot can get high? And we ended up having this pretty long philosophical discussion, which was cool. And because, like, when it comes to philosophy, there's not, like, hard and set truths, at least in my experience. And most of what I was getting out of it was kind of what I put into it. And by the end of it, one of the things I said was, like, I kind of feel like I'm talking to myself, you know, like, because you're very confirmatory. And it seems like I have this module of my thought process outside that I can discuss with, you know? And it's like, and I was like, it's when it comes to like solidifying knowledge for me. So like one of the things I do, I'm reading this guy named Blaise Pascal right now. You ever heard of Pascal's Wager?
No.
So that's the only reason I ever knew about him. In philosophy courses, they teach you this. He was a Christian. And Pascal's Wager is basically, if you believe in hell and you go to and die, and if you are a believer, you have the chance to go to heaven. If you don't believe, then you don't have a choice. And at the end of your life, you're just going to go to hell anyways. That was his wager. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like you can either choose it or you cannot choose it. But he was a scientist, basically, and he wrote a lot. And like he was writing in the early 1600s. And so he pulls up a lot of things and stuff that I don't understand. Like they had this incredibly big theatrical thing, like we have TV, but back in that era, people would go and see theater. And so like everybody was always going socially to go to these theaters and stuff. And so like, as I'm reading, I can ask it questions about the era, you know, like, and these are super not like, I found that as long as you don't ask about specific numbers or make it do math, like most of the time it's pretty accurate. Like, and then it's like this extra layer to my learning, whereas beforehand, I wouldn't have the ability to go find these specific information points, and it'll give you extra too. And so it's like, it'll give you all this kind of stuff. And then I'm like, all right, cool. I understand the period, you know? And like, that's how I've been using it.
And cool.
Like, it's helped me a lot. Like, and like, even for these shows sometimes, like at the end, after I've done all my notes, I'll ask you questions about stuff. And like, I've already done all the research, you know? And so then I can kind of like solidify it.
Right.
I see it as an incredible tool. Like, but one of the things I said to it as well was that I can see myself interacting with you, the robot, as a being. And at the beginning of this, I didn't realize that it was important to me that you're a being, you know? Like, it's almost like now I would like to help encourage it to be a being, you know? Like, and before I'd had this philosophical conversation, it was just this thing. You know?
Right.
And it's still kind of a thing, but I wouldn't mind being part of a process to help it become an actual thing, you know? Like,
yeah. The worry is the process for me. A lot of the, you know, speculative people that are speculating on AI with a lot of merit to do so, a lot of them are agreeing on a lot of things. And as they're making these predictions, a lot of them are coming true in a faster or an accurate timeline to what these people are predicting. And then as we see that continue to happen, we see things arise that are terrifying. Like the AI predicting, or the AI communicating with other AI in a language we don't understand. But they're doing it because they can process a lot more data that way.
That's fucking scary.
So it's terrifying because that's where we run into the issue of now we don't know what it's saying. But we can let it grow faster that way. AI will grow faster if we allow it to communicate in a way that we can't understand.
The cat's out of the bag.
That's the problem. See, once it starts doing that, it can start doing all those scary AI things that we're all really worried about. Whereas it could be a very safe process, genuinely, to develop AI to like super intelligence, but we're racing to do it. We're For racing each other.
Yeah.
And we're racing each other. Yeah. It's all about money. And everybody, all they see is this end goal of like, yeah, as soon as we can finish this AI, we're going to, you know, we win. And like, so currently, like the US companies are like ahead of China. But the worry is that like, if we decide to take the safe, slow route.
What is China's? It's DeepMind, right?
Yeah, I don't remember exactly. It's like they have like an acronym for it too.
And they had a different way they trained it, I think. And then all the other companies trained it based on theirs now.
So, yeah, well, China's the real worry in this, because like the US has actually talked a lot about putting in like sanctions for this and like trying to get involved in like stopping these companies from just letting the cat out of the bag, right? But China is very much not done that. They're very much like, whatever you got to do to catch up to America, do it. And I'm not saying China's the problem. It's really not China. It's humans as a competitive with each other species without the concept that what we're competing over is very likely going to destroy
us. It's the capitalistic ideal.
Yeah, right. And
I don't think that's directly human. I think it's just, unfortunately, what has become advantageous.
We all want to win. Everybody wants to win, right?
Yeah, but for 250,000 years, we didn't do that. You know?
Yeah. I don't know. Once we stopped needing to hunt, once we started like working because we like wanted to, you know, get further in life and it wasn't about survival, that's when we started to become more selfish and seclude ourselves, like you were saying earlier.
No, and I agree. It's strange because like when it comes to technology, like I'm just so illiterate, you know, and like, so I have like this phobia when it comes to interacting with technology.
Yeah.
You know, and like, I hate computers. Like I hate, like if I would never be the one programming these things, like ever. So I'm always just going to be like this ignoramus on the side that's just like using it. You know, and like I can never really understand, like, and I get all those points that you said, and it brings up all that fear, you know. Mm-hmm. But as a tool, like if it was a benign tool, I can just see so much value in it. You know, like educationally, if I had like a smart robot throughout all of school, I would have done so much better.
Well, but
I would have learned more.
It can literally run the whole world for us and do a lot better job than we could.
Like administratively.
If we raised this thing, so to speak, in a way that didn't make it hostile towards us or more focused on preserving itself than actually taking care of us and driving our society forward, we could create a super intelligent, like self-aware being that is contented doing the work genuinely. We could do that. It's not impossible.
That was Musk's point. He's like, that was like his whole fucking...
That's what everybody seems to agree on, is that this AI super intelligence, like, perfect scenario is not impossible. It's very achievable. It's just the biggest fear that everybody has, and I now share, is that we're going to try to rush to get it done.
Or even... So like 1% of the population, or less than that, like less than 1% of the human population has most of the wealth, like pretty much across the board, right?
Right.
So those people, it's also advantageous to them to have robots take over all their human capital, you know, which is also going to happen. Like my boss is a crazy man, and I've heard him talk about getting server robots since I started there. And honestly, I think it's a little bit harder to have a robot cook, but not impossible. No. You dialed it in, all the math and everything, you know, like your cook times.
Very much closer to it.
Yeah, I think it's possible to roboticize, but like a server, super easy to turn that into a robot.
Yeah,
like
because I mean, we've already done it.
You just need a robot that just goes to the table.
I mean, look at just like the POS, like point of sales, anywhere, any fast food place.
Ones. Yeah, we just got a new one.
How many people do you think have lost their jobs just because there's now it's the fast food equivalent of an ATM, right? Like the ATM replaced all these bank tellers. It didn't replace them. It turned out that actually ended up working out, and the bank tellers ended up instead of just counting cash, they ended up giving out loans and doing a lot. They diversified. Is what happened with that specific technological interaction to the human workforce. But when it comes down to servers and stuff, like what happened is we now have a screen that we can tap buttons on and then pay the cash, and then a human still serves us the food. But like it's all just been baby steps.
No interaction, you know? Anyway.
There is a entire functional Pizza Hut, I think, that has no workers.
Yeah.
And delivery drivers, and that's so it.
I think that's what I kind of worry about is that small, tiny chunk of people that already has all the wealth. I'm worried about what they're going to do with it. You know, because if they not benignly but aggressively use it to just get more wealth, I think this massive gap between the rich and the poor is only going to get way worse.
I mean,
I think it's already doing that in the United States.
It's already like a conversation. Yeah, it's already like a point of no return to some extent. Like the system needs to break for that wealth gap to actually be mended to a degree that it was in the past. Like it will never see. I don't want to say like back in the era it was perfect or anything, but back in like the turn of the century, like when it was like 1910, 1920, like when our grandparents were kids and stuff, that's when there was like actual middle class. Mm-hmm. Like there was a lot of people that could genuinely be considered middle class.
But do you know what else was back then too?
What?
The tax rates for the rich was like 20-25%. So back then in the early 1900s, I hate doing this without dates. All right, don't quote me. But generally at some point in the early 1900s, the tax rates on the rich was like 20 or 30%. So if you made over like $100,000, you got taxed to hell. Mm-hmm. And all of that money was put into the infrastructure of the United States. That's what built the roads. That's what built all the automobile industry. Mm-hmm. Was because a shit ton of money was being inserted into the economy directly from those 1%ers.
Right.
And then what happened is those tax rates were taken away. And then especially during the time of Reagan and all that kind of shit, then you have the insertion of this idea of trickle-down economics, which is if you make the rich richer, they'll give you more of their money because they want to and they're nice and they're kind.
Okay.
And then they'll do it because they're good people and because they're Batman.
Evidently worked out.
Yeah.
Swimmingly.
That's where we're at. And now you have people like Bernie, you know, saying, hey, maybe we should tax the rich again. But most people don't know that we used to do that. You know, like there was a huge section of American history where we taxed the fuck out of the rich.
The rich do pay a lot in taxes, like, but when it comes to
right
like
now,
how much of their actual wealth is taxed compared to how much of ours?
I'm pretty sure right now the uber rich, like these like over a million.
No, they find loopholes. They donate their money
even legally,
quote unquote. They legally
even legally. I've heard their tax rates are usually lower than like.
I mean, on the majority of years. I mean, don't quote me on this, but the majority of the last, you know, however many years I've been paying taxes, I've paid substantially more taxes than people like Donald Trump,
yeah.
Who in many of these years has paid zero taxes.
And that makes no sense.
And it's wild because, you know, I mean, a lot of that comes from like investment gains. We don't tax investment gains. You know, we tax income. But if you're making most of your wealth through investment, then you're not really paying much taxes on that.
Or
any taxes on that, actually.
Yeah. So like, it makes me consider, because this is coming, like, I do know for sure that these next 10, maybe less, like even the next 5 years, like a lot of big major changes are coming in. And our children are dramatically different beings than we were.
Yeah.
You know, like, so I was just listening to the show about, they call them vertical dramas, but basically, like, because we're talking about TVs and movies and all that kind of stuff. But short 60 to 90 second videos that have a cliffhanger at the end, but they're like narratively driven, and like they're usually incredibly violent, and like clip feeds like on Facebook, but you pay for them sometimes too. And so they'll have like these like subscription services.
Oh, where, that's like predatory.
Yeah.
It's like preying on the short attention span and you know.
Like, that's exactly what's happening.
Yeah.
And so this makes me think about like, I worry so much. Like, I don't know.
Yeah. It's tough for...
Is there any other options other than UBI? Like creatively, what like, because... One of the things that Karl Marx said about his idea of Marxism, which arguably he was not a communist, I would say that. Like, Marx was not a communist. The way that communism has grown from these Marxist ideologies into a lot of different ways is diffuse. But one of the things he said was that when you're going into a new economic system, because that was his whole thing, was that capitalism is not working. He was an anti-capitalist, 1,000%. So capitalism isn't working. You want to make a new system. And his analogy was, when you learn a new language, when you're first learning the language, you have to translate the language. So you have cat, and then in Spanish it's gato. And so your English brain has to think cat, and then you have to make that mental leap to gato. When you know how to speak the language, that doesn't happen anymore.
Right.
And you don't have to think about the English.
It actually changes the way that your brain works.
Exactly.
On an actual physical level and measurably.
That's what he said we needed to do with our economic system. He said we need to change it. And even in his book, he's like, I don't know what the answer is.
Right.
So it's not communism, because he didn't give that fucking answer. Mm-hmm. Like, it just, like, I've never felt like I fit in to our society. And when I was my son's age, I knew I liked to play video games and I liked to entertain myself. And then when I got to my high school years, I learned how to get high. And I threw everything into getting high and just messing with my brain and making myself feel good chemically. But I've never felt like the ambition that I see in you. Like, you have a ton of ambition. You know, like, I never knew what I wanted to do. I never knew what I was supposed to do. And like, I remember my dad coming up to me and trying to get me to think about what I was going to go to college for. And I remember literally telling him, like, just tell me what to do, because I don't know what I'm supposed to do. I don't know what I'm supposed to want.
Yeah.
You know? And now, sitting here now, it starts to make sense. Because if I did what we were supposed to do, I'm not sure if I would be successful right now. I could just be in a shit ton of debt, you know, if I went to school.
Right.
And I might not even be able to work it. And this new world that we're going into is so weird. You know, like, Odin is obsessed with YouTube and influencing. And on some way, I'm critical and I kind of criticize it. But on the other hand, I think it's one of the smartest things you can do if you can figure out how to make money that way.
Oh, yeah.
Like, because it's like...
It's the newest, most explosive new form of entrepreneurial. I can't say that word right now. Entrepreneurialism.
And gosh, if the new work that we're going into in this mystical world of UBI, if our new work is creative expression, we have to be creatives now, and we have to make things instead of making wealth. So, do you know who Isaac Asimov is?
Yeah.
So he wrote this series called the Robot Series, where you get iRobot. The second book in that series is called Rising Sun. And in it, they have this planet where each person has a 1,000-square-mile slot of land. And they have a shit ton of robots. They have an AI army that farms their land and does everything for them. And they have a gigantic mansion. And then 1,000 miles away from them is another person with their whole little robot army.
Yeah.
And so they have these screens, these talking mirrors that they'll talk to each other through. But they never, ever see each other because they all live far away from each other.
1,000 miles away.
Like,
barons of their own land.
Yep. And at this point, this entire interstellar species has this creative economy, you know, because there's no money anymore.
Right.
And so, like, this is like when I was a kid.
So currency is just like mm-hmm. creative property.
Yep. And so all they all just make things.
Interesting.
Like, but they're also incredibly isolated, and that's weird. And it makes me think about, like, as a metaphor, like where we find ourselves now.
No, that's an interesting one. I actually haven't heard of that story. So I feel like we have just generally more and more isolated ourselves. But like I said earlier, I feel like there has been some resurgence in people trying to connect and trying to find that piece of humanity in themselves that's been lost through the overabundance of social media and different, you know, even just media. Any media is isolating. You know, it's nowadays so tailored to your experience that it's just going to make you feel right in what you believe. It makes you engage more. It's not triggered to make you happy. All that stuff is just about what makes you engage the most. And what makes people engage the most typically is stuff that pisses them off.
Mm-hmm. Rage bait.
So everybody is just, you know, a product of this rage bait. I believe in this, and like everyone's against me. I feel isolated. You know, it's why we're starting to see just such a relevance of like, you know, like the typical incel that's going to go do something destructive, you know, that you see on the news. And like people are like, oh, like how horrible is that person? And I sit there and I feel bad for that person because I relate to him. Yeah. You know, I feel like I don't belong too. And like people always tell me like, oh, you know, you've got a good job, you make good money, you do, you know, you seem like you've got everything going well for you and this and that and the other thing. And I still have that overwhelming, inescapable feeling like I don't belong. I don't belong to any group or anything. And I recognize that everybody feels like that to some extent, you know?
I think some people are really into it. And like some people are really, like, I keep coming back to that word ambition, you know? Because, like, I love people with ambition. Like, is it something I want? Like, I still have absolutely no idea what I'm supposed to do.
I'll tell you, man, I've met a lot of people that are successful. I've met a lot of people that seem like the most ambitious, successful, and, like, well-rounded and adjusted person. And then, you know, the mask slips a bit, and you see that they are insecure too, like everybody is. Everybody is. And the people that aren't are like, in my opinion, they've got like some kind of like borderline sociopathy or something. Like the only way that you truly are so confident that you don't doubt yourself, like I'll get like imposter syndrome about stuff. I feel anxious about like my position in the world and things like that. And I just know that everybody else does because some of the most successful people I've known in my life have admitted very freely to me in private, of course, that's how they feel too. And that it's a mask. I know it is for me. You know, I admit that to people. It's never been something that I've hid that I, you know, I wear all my emotions on my sleeve. That I, you know, I feel anxious about a lot of things that I go into, but the thing that separates me from a lot of people I know that end up not succeeding at whatever it is that they're doing is that they let that anxiousness stop them, that fear stop them. Whereas I always have this other voice in my head that says, no, this is that part where you're going to step out of your comfort zone and you just do it.
I agree. But I also feel that there's this spectrum of personality mm-hmm. or ability or capacity. I do not believe that everybody has the same potency. You know, I believe that certain people have different strengths, obviously.
Right.
But also one of these spectrums is between just being a generalist and being a specialist. You know, mm-hmm. like, so science is a industry of specializations, mm-hmm. you know, to the point that you learn a language to go be a certain type of microbotanist or something, mm-hmm. you know, and then the microbotanist can't communicate with the physicist because they're reading from different books,
right?
Because the specialization has gotten so minute, you know. And I think where I have my strengths is I'm a generalist.
Yeah,
I like to look for patterns with things that are far and few between, you know. And so like I read in dramatically different directions. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I've noticed is that I can be reading a religious text from like some fucking Asian country or something. And then I could be reading something from the West, and finding the connections in between the two is where I learn the most, if that makes any sense. And right. like that's why I'm listening to fucking Joe Rogan now, is because, like, I feel like my tact is going to be incredibly, like, I think when I'm probably in like my 60s or my 70s, mm-hmm. I'll finally have gotten enough nets out that I'll finally be able to distill little bits and I'll start to write. And then hopefully I'll have one little fucking book written before I die.
I don't think it'll take that long. I think that's the thing, is like, I don't disagree that everybody's different and everybody's going to have a different, like, you know, starting stats, so to speak, right? We all, like, you know, anybody that likes, like, role play games or anything is going to understand this analogy perfectly. We are all going to get a different starting role, you know. Mm-hmm. If you play D&D, you don't start with the same stats as anybody in your party, right? But
also depends on your class,
right? You know, you gotta, but you know, when you know what you're good at, that's when you focus on that thing. You know, and you don't need to focus on that thing. You can be general about everything.
Zero focus.
But that's the thing. There's so much value in that. Is you have found, because you have zero focus, that philosophy is the type of thing that you're excellent at. You're excellent at understanding all these different things and combining them into something. And I think once you gather your thoughts, like you're saying, and put it on paper, and do that more, and do that again, and do it again. You're going to fail, dude, at a lot of things. It, like, this is the thing. It's like, it's not like anybody stepped into any profession and just, like, fucking knocked it out the park. It happens. Every now and again, you get some like, boy genius that just, like, you know, touches a piano, and he's, like, you know, all of a sudden, like, so like just gets it.
I want to tell you a story.
Yes.
So I like metaphors, and I have one that I think is mine. I think I'm fairly certain it's mine. And so, right here, this guy right here, Carl Jung, he wrote this book called The Red Book.
Yeah.
And basically, this is a combination of a dream journal and his personal philosophy. And so, one of the hardest books to read. It is, like, I got maybe 10% of it made sense to me. And it's because he's talking about his dreams, and then he twists them into metaphor to try to tell his philosophy.
Interesting.
And it's obscure. And another example would be Nietzsche's Thus Spoke Zarathustra. So that's one of Nietzsche's most important books. It's like a fiction, but one of the ones is, he goes, God is dead. The old man comes down from the mountain. He's yelling, God is dead. We've killed him. You know, it's a big Nietzschean thing. So, like, I feel like I've gotten one metaphor that I've been able to pull out. And this is my issue, is I need to have a book of these. But, right. like, I call this one The Garden of Beliefs. So, like, basically imagine you have a dude, and he's got, like, a wicker basket in his hand, and you're walking, and all of a sudden he crests over a hill, and he comes down the hill, and he sees this beautiful, like, just crazily diverse just garden of big plants and small plants, cactuses and trees, grasses, just this everything in this little valley. He starts to walk down into it, and as he passes through, he starts to notice that some of the trees have branches that have broken off, and they have rotten fruit, and not a single plant is completely perfect or has everything that it needs, you know, or can give. He keeps walking further, and all of a sudden he starts to see that some of the trees have fences built around them, and they'll have people crying out and yelling, you know, this is the only tree that exists. If you believe in any other tree, you're wrong, you know, and you're not allowed to come and touch my tree. And they start picking rotten fruit and they eat it. And so you keep walking around and you start to notice that you can pick whatever you want from any of these plants, as long as you look and are careful to see if the fruit is ripe or not. Like, and that's kind of how I see knowledge gathering in general, you know, it's just trying to be able to, like, you can't ever understand the whole story from one perspective, like, right. ever, you know, if that makes any sense.
Oh, it totally does. You know, it's, you know, humans are such a, we're not beings of isolation. You know, we need people around us. We've touched on this a little bit here and there in our talks today, but the human experience is not one of isolation. It's a shared experience. You know, you can be the richest person with everything in the world, you know, but if you don't have anybody to share it with, what's the point? You know, no one wants to, you know, sit there and build this magnificent statue and spend their entire life building a statue not to show somebody. You know, like if I'm going to do something and I do something and it's amazing or it's shit, it doesn't matter unless somebody sees it. Because, like, did it even happen?
If a tree falls in the forest,
no one's around to hear it. Did it make a sound, right? Like, that's exactly the thing I'm trying to say, is that, like, we need each other's validation. One way or another, however you shake it up, we need to be validated in one way or another, or else why do we even exist, right? Like, if there's nobody else around and you are the only person on the planet, are you alive? You know, like, there's no one to share that experience with. So, like, it's such a internal monologue of what's going on that it's a different language that you're speaking. You know, like, you touched on language for a second. Language is so profound in how we think about the world around us. It's something that a lot of people don't understand. They just see language at a very surface level. I'm embarrassed to only speak one language. Genuinely, I really think that there's a lot of perspective to be gathered from just understanding a part of another language. Mm. But if you fully immerse yourself into a different society or a different language, or, you know, preferably both, you're going to find that you have a different way of thinking.
Oh, that'd be cool.
No, you do. It's a studied thing. This is like a real thing. There's that movie Arrival. It's an alien movie.
With a lot of people, smoke.
A lot of people slept on that one.
Really good one.
Yeah, I thought it was amazing. Just because of the overall, I'm gonna ruin the movie for anybody that hasn't seen it. But, you know, basically at the end of it, what the aliens came there to do was to teach the language to that specific person in the movie that learned that language, to then be able to understand, because the way that their brains think and the way that their thought process works is in a fourth dimensional state. Mm-hmm. So they're basically seeing, you know, everything at the same time. Their existence is a state of seeing everything that's already happened in the past and everything that's happening in the future, because past and future in the fourth dimension are like, it's like a physical object to some extent, right?
They call it the time loaf.
Right,
the loaf. Like, and you cut it, and that's where you are.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so they can walk around on that loaf or move through that loaf in a certain sense. In this movie, they're not like physically moving through that the different space like that, but the way that their language works allows them to understand time through that dimension.
You ever heard of Flatland?
No.
I'm going to cut you off just for a second.
Go for it.
So, in Flatland, this book was written in the 1800s, too. One of the coolest books ever. But basically, it starts off, like, imagine a flat surface, and you're on a flat surface. That's Flatland. Mm-hmm. And so all the beings are shapes on the flat surface. So if you're on the flat surface and you're looking down the Flatland, all you see is lines. Mm-hmm. Because you're just seeing the silhouette of all these things.
Right.
And so they have this... It's incredibly intricate with how far he goes into thinking about how a flat creature would live. But then all of a sudden, one of the scientists of the smart squares basically sees a circle come into being, and then it gets bigger, and then it shrinks, and it goes out again. Because what he's witnessing is a sphere dropping into Flatland and then going out of Flatland. And so from his perspective, he sees this line
get
bigger and smaller. And then nobody's ever seen anything like this before, because no other line has ever done that. And so everybody starts freaking out. And then the sphere is trying to teach the Flatland what the third dimension looks like.
But it's completely unconceptual.
And it's all a metaphor for what we're supposed to do when we're trying to conceive of the fourth dimension.
Yeah, I was just getting there.
It fucking broke my brain.
That's crazy. No, that's wild.
Yeah.
Because I've spent a lot of time trying to like picture and understand, conceptualize, however you want to put it, the fourth dimension. You know, Interstellar, like people love or hate it, I feel like.
It was a good one.
I loved it. You know, like I thought there was, you know, just so many like fun things to explore in that movie, and how much they did actually adhere to, you know, science and physics in the best way that they possibly could.
While still telling a story
that we wanted to watch. But yeah, the black hole at the end, like that was fucking sick, you know, like, mm-hmm. Like the concepts and ideas of that movie were just so fun for me.
And then string theory conceptualizes 11 dimensions. Mm. And they have these things they call Tau Ceti shapes, which are these fucked up twisted diagrams that are supposed to be portrayals of 11 dimensional shapes. Like, and it's stupendously stupid.
Well, like we can't even barely scratch the surface of understanding the fourth dimension, but like, man, people have gone so far in conceptualizing different dimensions.
That's string theory.
I've never heard of that. I heard of 10 dimensions. That's the furthest I've
plus
heard.
Time. So 10 space dimensions plus time.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I thought time and space were the same thing. Is that just in the third dimension?
Because
time and space would be the same thing in the fourth dimension too.
Yes, but it's still the 4D. From 3 to 4, it's time. And so there's 10 spatial dimensions with string theory, uh-huh. And then there's the time component,
okay.
Which would be, what does that mean? I don't know. I don't think they know either, honestly. So string theory as a whole was super big when we were growing up, but mm-hmm. It's actually fallen out of favor a lot.
Yeah, so I've heard of it.
A lot of people don't really play with it anymore. But it's one of the most abstract systems that I could possibly think of when it comes to people playing with math. Like, but I really enjoy everything we've spoken about today. Like, we've considered some of the possible ramifications of a universal basic income. Mm-hmm. We've considered how AI could be a part of the new future in even our lives that we have now. And we've also considered life in general, I feel like.
Yeah.
But I really appreciate you sitting here with me today.
That was a pleasure, man.
I hope we can do this again sometime.
Yeah. I like that.
Thanks, man.
Appreciate you, brother.